Everyone in the West has dug his head into the sand like ostriches. No one wants to admit these problems exist.
Is America headed towards bankruptcy, the collapse of a worldwide empire? How would you survive if gas or oil get way too expensive or sometimes not available at all? Maybe we could learn something from the fallen Soviet Union, where people had to remake a new society. Today we are joined by a former Russian who witnessed the Soviet collapse. He is an engineer who has worked on high energy physics and things like internet security. Now Dmitry Orlov has written a really useful book about civilizations in trouble. Welcome, Dmitry.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, of course, we're going to talk about your new book, Reinventing Collapse, the Soviet Example and American Prospects. But first, I'd like to plunge right into something else you've written with your advice for the next American government. I mean, we're $9 trillion in debt the day the new president takes office, at least. We heard some unreal promises from Obama and McCain. Can you tell us about your collapse party platform?
Well, it's basically a mock political party because no government ever actually explicitly prepares for collapse. They do everything they can to avert or postpone it, and sometimes those efforts bring the collapse closer than the instead of helping defer it. But I identified a few things that I thought would be worth doing, just basically in an effort to prevent disasters that are avoidable. One of those, for instance, is not letting troops, American troops, which are scattered all over the globe, become stranded overseas, sometimes in hostile lands, sometimes in indifferent lands, and not letting their weapons fall into the wrong hands. The United States maintains over 1,000 military bases around the world. A lot of them don't actually serve much of a purpose, and they require a functioning civilian economy in order to resupply those bases. They're not self-sufficient. They use copious amounts of fossil fuels, basically oil-derived things like gasoline and diesel. And that is really not something that this country will be able to keep going after the economy shuts down. So I would think that repatriating those soldiers as soon as possible, shutting down and cleaning up the bases, bringing all this war material back into the United States or destroying it. These are all excellent ideas. Another thing that I would like to see done is secure all the nuclear fuel and nuclear installations. After the fall of the Soviet Union, by a happy accident more than anything else, none of the fissile material fell into the hands of terrorists, and there were no Chernobyl-like disasters. There were some reports of radiation leaks, but nothing to rival Chernobyl. I really don't want to see fissile material falling into the wrong hands, and also I don't want to see nuclear power plants become abandoned if there is no way to maintain them. So they should be shut down, and the nuclear fuel that's stored at those locations should be transferred to someplace safer. Another thing I would like to see done is a gradual whittling down of the prison population instead of a chaotic general amnesty when the resources to maintain that prison population run out. Luckily, that is already starting to happen because various states, even prosperous ones like Connecticut, are paroling nonviolent offenders. A lot of them are there because of drug charges, because of draconian drug laws. And they're paroling them ahead of time because they're running out of money. So that's really a good trend. And lastly, the last thing I would like to see happen is there are a lot of unrepayable debts that are still carried on the books, being treated as repayable, and it's just a waste of effort. And I think that a general jubilee, forgiveness of all of these unrepayable debts, a giant reset would be very therapeutic and helpful and wipe the slate clean. And if we do it while there is still some scope for government action, because the government isn't shut down due to lack of resources, you know, that would actually that might help people prepare, you know, bring in some element of reality into people's lives. So those are basically the things that I half-jokingly thought would be worth doing, because I don't expect them to be done.
Well, you sound really sane to me. You've got my vote. You know, even if the economy somehow stumbles along, most of those things need to be done so that we could retool into a really sustainable life with a really productive economy again. Now, I don't want to belabor this point, but you've talked about collapse. Can you fairly briefly try and say why you think the situation in America is so serious?
Well, if you look at energy specifically, it's really clear what is about to happen, what is unfolding as we speak, really. The United States imports over two-thirds of petroleum and petroleum products at this point. It's the single biggest contribution to the trade deficit. It's beginning to dwarf the trade imbalance with China, for instance. It probably will after the price of oil doubles a few more times. And that is not really a sustainable scenario, because what's happening now is that Americans are printing more and more money with which to buy oil, but the nations that sell oil don't really want any more dollars, because it's not really a very trustworthy currency at this point. It keeps depreciating. So they'll be holding back their reserves. Another effect that's happening is exporting nations, which most of them are post-peak and are basically looking to conserve their patrimony in terms of their oil endowment. They don't really want to squander it. If in a situation where you can cut down your oil exports, say by a factor of two, and the price of oil as a response to that will go up by a factor of two, then it's a wash that you have more oil left. So they would probably try to squelch their oil exports as opposed to boost them, which is not good news for the U.S. And lastly, they're so flush with revenue from their oil exports that as they invest this revenue in their own economy, their economies grow and consume more energy, meaning that there is less oil available for export. So all of those things combined mean that the U.S. is going to be maybe gradually, maybe suddenly, but cut off from two-thirds of all the oil that's required to run this economy. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that it's really all built around oil. There's very little that can happen economically in the United States that does not require oil. And if we, say, wanted to build something that doesn't run on oil, right, that runs on solar or hydro or, you know, horse manure or what have you, you have to go and take out a loan. Now, what's going to be the collateral for that loan? Well, it's going to be things that run on oil, right? Jet aircraft, heavy equipment, what have you. And as you're constructing that thing, you're going to be using oil. So it's not likely that all of that equipment that burns oil is going to be very valuable as collateral if oil is in short supply. So you won't get that loan. So basically, all of those things put together mean that there isn't really much of a future for an economy in the United States of the size that exists today. It's going to be much smaller. Now, a smaller economy cannot maintain and service a huge debt. So that means bankruptcy.
We're talking with Dmitry Orlov. His new book is Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. It's just out from New Society Publishers. Well, you know, when I'm thinking about what happened in the Soviet Union, I've got this sort of fuzzy picture like, well, we won or something, and then maybe the mafia had a role, and it's all very mixed up with Yeltsin in there drinking heavily, perhaps. We really don't know anything about it. What could you tell us about what happened in the Soviet Union and how that might apply to future events right here in North America?
Well, a lot of things went wrong in the Soviet Union. You know, too many to count. But what really made the whole proposition of maintaining the empire untenable was, again, energy. Russian oil production peaked a few years, about 3 years, something like that, before the Soviet Union collapsed. Oil was what allowed Russia to earn foreign currency with which to buy grain on the world market from the United States, from Canada. And the Soviet Union became complacent during the years when they were flush with oil production and oil prices were high. They were very high in the 70s, relatively. And so they became complacent, and they got used to this way of behaving where they thought they could just continue to buy whatever they needed from the West. Now, what happened after their production peaked is it coincided with the North Sea in Norway and the UK and Prudhoe Bay in Alaska coming on stream. And suddenly there was a miraculous economy, recovery of the economies of the West, which was wrongly attributed to Thatcherite and Reaganite politics, but really it just had to do with the fact that oil was suddenly cheap again. But what that meant for the Soviet Union is they suddenly saw their revenues plummet, but they became so dependent on these imports that they had to borrow money in order to continue receiving them. And the Soviet Union at the very end started taking on foreign debt at a rate that could not be sustained. And that put it pretty much at the mercy of foreign creditors. You know, it made Soviet foreign policy basically a dead letter. You know, so the collapse of the Berlin Wall from that point on was just basically, you know, creditors demanding their pound of flesh.
Well, that could certainly happen. In America, we're seeing some of the oil-rich governments buying into American banks, buying into American real estate. Pretty soon, they may be able to call some tunes, do you think?
I think they're already doing it to a fair extent. It used to be that the U.S. government thought that, you know, some foreign government took their reserves, you know, treasury paper, and sold it and tried to buy their way into the American economy, basically snapping up private equity. That would be considered almost like an act of war. That policy went by the wayside some time ago, you know, which is a sign of desperation. And now we have sovereign wealth funds buying up big chunks of banks. Whenever a bailout is required, they're basically invited to the table. And what that really is a surrender of sovereignty. So that, for instance, the Saudis will be able to rent or buy outright big chunks of the Midwest and grow food there and export it, even if there is malnutrition and starvation in the United States. And the people in this country won't be able to do very much about it. Yes, this country is being surrendered piece by piece to foreign creditors.
Another example I could take from Soviet history seems serious to me. Just take a second here. Back in 1932, when the main cities, particularly Moscow, ran out of food for the citizens, the troops were sent out into the country to grab anything they could find from the farmers, even the seeds for next year's planting. I think that could happen again. I mean, no government, even in nice countries like Canada or Britain, supposedly, is going to let masses of people in the big cities get too hungry. So the powers that be to feed the cities will go out and get whatever they need. And I wonder, you know, our food's coming from the other side of the world right now. The whole city system seems a bit unstable to me. Would you agree with that premise?
Well, there are things that can be done in many cities. It depends. For instance, you know, Las Vegas or Phoenix, Arizona, nothing will ever grow there. They don't have water. There's plenty of sunshine, but no water. But there are various other places which basically can reform themselves Havana style. For instance, instead of importing vegetables into the city, you can import dirt. And you only have to import the dirt once. And then people convert parking lots into raised bed agriculture by nailing together boxes. And they convert highways, because there's no traffic anymore, because there's no oil, into water catchment systems for irrigation. You know, they grow chickens and rabbits and guinea pigs and whatever else you can, you know, on the rooftops and balconies. And they can stay fed that way. It's a different approach, but it's viable. And it's actually more viable than a rural population that doesn't isn't really used to being self-sufficient. They usually grow one or two cash crops, but then they go shopping to the supermarket, which can be quite a distance away and requires them to drive. So once that lifestyle is no longer available to them, the rural scene is much more difficult to make sustainable in some ways than the city scene, where a concerted effort can be made and the people are right there to do it.
Well, this is one of the things I like about your work. It isn't just a negative put down at all. You do offer a lot of really useful ideas about rethinking and reorganizing our lives. In a way, we might all come out better in the long run. In fact, you say young people could thrive after the crash. How could that be?
Well, there are a lot of things that are quite ridiculous. Having gone through this educational system for a while, you know, there is a certain ridiculous aspect to, the success scenario as it's being touted, basically going through lots and lots of courses, cramming for tests and learning lots of things that you then quickly forget because it's really all a test of short-term memory. Because that's how the educational system is really structured. I find that is fairly ridiculous. I think saddling yourself with educational debt, as a lot of students in the U.S. have to do, and then being forced to take on some soulless corporate job instead of doing what you want with your life and just basically wasting a huge chunk of your life doing things that you were initially not really interested in at all because, you know, they wouldn't have occurred to you except that those were the choices you were given. All of those things can be replaced with something, you know, a lot more, sustaining, spiritually sustaining. For instance, if instead of going through engineering school, as I did, I went through an apprenticeship and became a boat builder, for instance, I probably wouldn't have wasted so many years doing things I wasn't interested in before I got into boats. That's just a personal example, but everybody is really interested in something, and most of the time they don't get to do it because the economy doesn't require it, because there's no profit in it for whoever runs the economy. And so if the profit motive is destroyed in a collapse, it's sort of a reset and people get to think about what they really want and how little they can get away with doing of the things that they don't want to do. And I think it's a much, much saner way to live in some ways.
Well, I was just at a car-free festival, where they closed down the streets and people came out and celebrated just being alive. There were a lot of young people there. It gave me quite a bit of hope, and I thought, well, yeah, this is what the city really could be like without this oil-based economy. And there could be some new movements and a lot of involvement and a lot of community building ahead of us.
Absolutely. My whole life now is one big car-free festival. I've given up on cars a few years ago. I just bicycle everywhere. I bicycle and I sail. I bought a tank of gas for my sailboat. I have a little outboard to push it around in and out of the marina. I bought it a few months ago. I think it'll last me halfway through the summer. I think I might go through two gas tanks this year. So, I'm a little bit fossil fuel dependent, but nothing like the people who drive back and forth all day.
We're chatting with Dmitry Orlov. He's the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, just out from New Society Publishers. He has a lot of friends like James Howard Kunstler, KMO, Rand Preer, Jan Lundberg, and Matt Savinar. And they're all listed as part of Club Orlov, and that's where you can tune into Dmitry's site on the web. Orlov is spelled O-R-L-O-V. His blog is cluborlov.blogspot.com. Well, I notice your publisher, Dmitry, is based in Canada, and I know you've just finished a lot of interviews with right-wing radio hosts in the United States. The right seems to own the AM talk show dial down there. Do you have trouble finding a publisher, and what's the main reaction from these radio jocks? Do they call you a commie, or do they resist it, or are they listening?
I think I can sort of, amazing as it sounds, browbeat them into submission half the time. And I'm sort of amazed that I can do it anyway. I guess I can be pretty obnoxious if I try. But they're certainly obnoxious. And as far as the publisher, it was really no problem finding the publisher. I was asked to provide a review of another book. And while I was doing that, I chatted with the editor and said, well, I have some articles. I was thinking of putting together a book. Are you interested? And they said, well, give us a proposal. So I gave them a proposal. It was accepted, and that was that. It was really very simple. No agent, nothing. Just walked in through the door. And I'm very happy with what they did. I think the book came out well. You know, they worked very hard on it. You know, they improved it hugely. So, but as far as the radio thing, I think the thing that depresses me is, if anything, is that, you know, I've been able to reach many, many, many people, but none of them seem to read books. So they're sitting in their cars, they're listening to the radio, they may have, you know, laughed, cried, whatever, but none of them probably went and bought my book.
Well, they don't read. I'm going to disagree with you. I'll bet you find that some of them did. People sort of react with denial at first, but there are still a few book readers out there. And, well, it's good that you're on radio with us now, because for those who like to listen to their information, they're getting it straight from you. And I wanted to ask you, before we close off, is there something else that you'd really like to talk about, something that my questions haven't reached?
Well, I really want to stress something that, you know, very few people point out, is that there's this great division between the big picture. It's important to know what's going on in the big world, you know, to have the big picture, to have this realization that, you know, the mass media is really hiding the truth from us in a lot of ways, and you have to find your own truth, and it's fairly difficult. But once you do, you can form your own picture of what's going on in the world. And at the same time, it's very important to do practical things in your own life. And a lot of people have trouble making that transition. You know, a lot of people's lives lack the flexibility to make incremental changes. And I just want to say that it's easy and pleasant. Like, you know, I got rid of my car and you know, that was, you know, an abrupt transition. And I felt uncomfortable for a little while because I had a lot of habits centered around the car, as we all do, that had to basically die away over a period of time. And similar changes can be made, and they seem like wrenching changes, but in retrospect, they don't seem that wrenching. So I would encourage people to experiment with their lives. Don't just passively absorb the big picture and become depressed by it, or you know, have some other reactions, but not really do anything about it, because you can't do something about it. It's just that it doesn't concern the big world. It concerns you, the people you know, the relationships around you, and what you do.
Well, that's some really good advice. I know people do watch the screen or go on the net, and they get somewhat stunned by it all, and they're too busy trying to make a living to do anything. But I agree with you. I'm trying to make incremental changes. I've changed my diet. I'm heading towards vegetarianism, for example. And I think all of those things will eventually add up, and they certainly pay off for me with better health and lower costs. So I want to thank Dmitry Orlov for coming on Radio EcoShock. We've barely scratched the surface. Maybe we can have you back again in the fall, and I don't mean the fall of civilization. I mean next autumn, if you're willing.
Absolutely. It would be a pleasure.
All right. Well, I'm Alex Smith, and thank you all for listening. Find more free audio at our website, ecoshock.org.